from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, spreading east farther and maybe even faster than NATO, Le Show's newest affiliate is in Georgia, the nation of Georgia, not the state of Georgia, not Peach Country. We're talking Tbilisi. You're welcome. On GIPA Radio 94.3, the first 24-hour English-language radio station in the Caucasus. That's right, it's Caucasoid Radio. And we're on. It's a non-commercial station dedicated to the principles of fairness, independence, honesty, and accuracy in its programming. We'll fix that. And Jonathan, a former Santa Monican, is there. Maybe is the reason. But anyway, let's put it this way. It's one more station Imus isn't on. Ladies and gentlemen, this program is originating from New Orleans, Louisiana. And the now all too familiar template of A Tale of Two Cities holds once again this weekend. It's a brisk, beautiful, clear day. The wind is up enough that you really could get some turbines going and make some electricity. And the French Quarter is full of music and food and people. This is a French Quarter Festival, which I'd never seen before, but people had always said, that's the one. That's the one. And I was walking along the riverfront Friday, and breeze off the river, and people just hanging around, all colors, all combinations, the strange and the normal, neither knowing which is which, seemed pretty good. And then you open yesterday's local newspaper, and the United States Army Corps of Engineers, which built the levees and flood walls that collapsed, resulting in the flooding of New Orleans a couple years ago. You hear about it? I think Anderson Cooper had something on it. They revealed, don't you know, that one of the problems with the flood walls is that the sheet piling, we went through this with Dr. Van Heerden last year, the sheet piling wasn't driven deep enough to anchor the flood walls. There's this piece of concrete, and underneath there's an anchoring wall of steel that's driven into the ground to anchor the concrete. Well, it wasn't driven down deep enough. So they found, said the Army Corps of Engineers, a piece of sheet wall, I think it's new, along the same canal, the 17th Street Canal, the one that disastrously failed, one of the three that disastrously failed, where the sheet piling is 10 feet shorter than the one that failed. And they're saying, it'll be okay. It's good. We've done tests. Trust us. And the people who are looking over their shoulder saying, no, this is good. They're doing the work right. Is them. They're the only people who are evaluating themselves. A professor at Berkeley who led an independent team that looked into the matter last year said, in the quote in the paper, it gives me the heebie-jeebies. So it's good and it's bad, and hello, welcome to the show.
Making love one day with a girl they call a Mamie. Making love one day with a girl they call a Mamie. I picked up Mamie by the railway, and we took a taxi straight to Clarkston Bay. Before we lay down on the carpet, she stopped catching fits.
Oh, Papa, don't fight me. Don't do that on me. I never had a man who ever did that to me.
She hooked me, and I hooked she. Like
two snakes rolled up. She saw deceitful, she bawling stuff. But she likes it, I know that. From the way she started to scratch me like a cat. Let me go, let me go. Oh, God, sweet Papa, no, no, no.
Oh, Papa, don't fight me. Don't do that, honey. I never had a man who ever did that to me. Aye, 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 do-do, my darling.
Getting bit by sand fly. I keep on scratching and scratching. All this time I know that there are people watching. Wait, wait, Mamie. A sand fly bite me down there.
Whoa, Papa, don't bite me. Don't you do that to me, honey. I never had a man who ever did that to me.
Hey, 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 where you going, Papa?
Make me pause right up. You're making me stop, Papa, stop.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain. Boy, the I think that's the London Avenue Canal is right out the window. That makes me feel safe. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. I'm sure that sheep pond is driven deeper and deeper. It's, as we speak, I'm watching the cranes do it. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, as severe weather threatens the Northeast right now, don't necessarily want to be eating that food that FEMA might give you. According to Logistics Director Eric Smith, FEMA is stockpiling about 12 million meals ready to eat. $70 million worth of meals ready to eat. This year. But FEMA doesn't seem to know how to store the stuff. Says Logistics Director Eric Smith, quote, "We don't have the rated facilities, management structure, or the know-how to make sure that the meals and products we buy are adequately managed to later meet approved standards for consumption," unquote.
Ugh.
All right, then. I'm fine. Hunger's fine. I'll be hungry. It's good. I could take a few off. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble.
Hey,
The British and U.S. policy towards Iraq has, quote, spawned new terror in the region, according to a think tank report. It's damn thinking. It's tanking. The countries had tried to, quote, keep the lid on, quote, problems by military force and had failed to address the root causes, according to the Oxford Research Group. It said Iran, Syria, and North Korea had become emboldened, while the Taliban was on the rise in Afghanistan. I say that's mission accomplished, wouldn't you? Separate report from Oxfam, British charity, says the Iraq invasion had seriously undermined Britain's reputation. Treating Iraq as part of the war on terror created a combat training zone for jihadists, says the report. Lead study author Chris Abbott says there's a clear and present danger, an increasingly marginalized majority living in an environmentally constrained world where military force is more likely to be used to control the consequences of these dangerous divisions. It says any military intervention in Iran would be disastrous. And it warns Iran should not be allowed to develop civilian nuclear power. So there you go. We've spawned new terror in the region, ladies and gentlemen. News from outside the bubble. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And there's more about what's going on in the new Iraq. Millions of Iraqis are in a disastrous situation that is getting worse, with mothers appealing for someone to pick up the bodies on the street so their children would be spared the horror of looking at them on the way to school. That's nice. That's according to the International Red Cross. It's the Red Cross that works. What? What did he say? Thousands of bodies lie unclaimed in mortuaries, with family members either unaware that they're there or too afraid to recover them, according to the agency's director of operations, Pierre Krehenbuhl. Medical professionals are also fleeing the country after cases where their colleagues were killed or abducted. Hospitals and other key services are desperately short of staff, Krehenbuhl said. According to the Iraqi Ministry of Health, more than half the doctors have already left the country. Well, you know what? Give them medical dramas. If you can't give them doctors, give them medical dramas. At least let them see some doctors on TV. The report, quote, civilians without protection, the ever-worsening humanitarian crisis in Iraq. Does that sound like bad news? Unquote. Was produced over the last 2 to 3 weeks, well after they stepped up American military operations in the capital. The report went beyond the usual appeals by the International Red Cross for all sides to protect civilians. It added photographs and quotes from civilians to describe the situation. Says the spokesperson for the ICRC, it reflects the situation on the ground now. Overall, the situation in the country has been steadily deteriorating, says the report, with numbers of refugees swelling. You don't want those swollen refugees. It's hard to find clothing for them. Medical staff fleeing and other problems growing, says Krehenbuhl. A colleague recently asked several Iraqi, a colleague of Krehenbuhl's, recently asked several Iraqi women what their most pressing need was. After a long silence, the women answered, quote, the most important thing anyone could do would be to help collect the bodies that line the streets in front of our homes every morning. That would be nice. Maybe the company that is doing the new wonderful job of cleaning up the French Quarter. Yes, amidst all this, it's a new company that's getting raves for the cleanliness of the French Quarter, ladies and gentlemen. I would hesitate to say this at any other time, but I was actually on Bourbon Street yesterday, walking down Bourbon Street, going from one place to another, and it actually didn't smell that way. You know what I mean? Maybe you don't know what I mean, but I know what I mean, and it didn't smell that way. So congrats to somebody in the Department of Cleaning at Bourbon Street. You know, there is a the trend toward adults wearing braces on their teeth. Boy, that was a whiplash, if ever I experienced one. That change of topic. But we move that way. It's 21st century now. That trend has finally reached Australia. Like last week, the trend toward restricting the amount of liquids and gels you could take on board a flight, that's finally reached Australia 9 months later. Now, they've taken up braces for adults, you see, because it's hip. And says one real estate broker in her late 20s, Kim Britt, she and many of her friends now have braces. Quote, "In my work, it's important to look good and have confidence. With all the celebrities having teeth whitening and cosmetic work done, there's now more pressure than ever to look a certain way," unquote. In case you wonder about our contribution to the world. And, says orthodontist Dr. Igor Laverin, "It's about the aesthetic. You get a better smile and we're more image-focused than we were 10 years ago when the Aussies looked so bad." However, ladies and gentlemen, a recent British study found braces did nothing to improve mental well-being or quality of life in adulthood. You know, wear those things for nothing. Researchers at the University of Manchester's Dental School followed 1,000 school children over 20 years. They found that while the children with braces were happier with their teeth, this had no impact on their self-esteem. But their teeth had better self-esteem, I guess, is the conclusion. All right. We know nothing more than that about wearing braces at the moment. Ladies and gentlemen, the Washington Post, I believe, today pinpoints a new potentially large issue in the upcoming presidential primary politics. Yucca Mountain. Isn't that the thing I've been yapping about periodically for a while now? Yes, it is. Thank you for asking. Yucca Mountain is, as you may or may not know, the only place in America that's even thought about seriously now as a long-range repository for high-level nuclear waste. See, if we're going to be cranking up that nuclear industry like they're talking about, just every time you hear them talking about clean, efficient nuclear energy, which, by the way, uses uranium to boil water, in case it's escaped you that that's what's really going on. We're using uranium, ladies and gentlemen, to boil water because we're that smart. So anytime you hear about that project on the upswing, the BBC just did a big report on the upswing of nuclear energy in India, and nobody asked this question. Where's the waste going? Waste's got to go somewhere, and it's got to go somewhere for a long time. The half-life of this stuff is considerably longer than, let's say, the Don Imus controversy. So, as I said, the Washington Post this weekend now says, well, it's going to be an issue in the politics of the presidential primaries because one of the first caucuses, not the caucuses I'm on the air in, one of the first caucuses is going to be in Nevada, where Yucca Mountain is. And people in Nevada don't want the nuclear waste there. You tell me where anybody wants it. Nevada officials now have called for a federal investigation into a U.S. Department of Energy computer program that's being used to submit the license application for the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump. Maybe they need to find a nicer word than dump, first of all. You know, just to tart it up a little bit. Just to make it smell, you know, better, like Bourbon Street. But the story continues. The Department of Energy's computer model is so complicated, it appears, that no one outside the Department of Energy can check the program for the accuracy of its data or access all the information needed to review the Yucca Mountain project. Maybe they're learning from the Corps of Engineers. We'll inspect ourselves. Thanks so much. This, according to Bob Liu, the executive director of Nevada's Agency for Nuclear Project. The program in question, the Department of Energy's computer program, requires the coordinated use of hundreds of computers, processors, and software, some of which is already obsolete, according to Lou. According to Lou, is that on ABC too? We doubt there is even anyone in DOE who has a comprehensive command of the entire model, he wrote in a letter to the chairman of the U.S. Regulatory Commission, the agency that will approve or reject the license application for Yucca Mountain. The DOE will file the application by June 2008. Yucca Mountain is designed to be a permanent storage site. Note the use of the word permanent, because stuff that, you know, people build always is permanent. We know that. March 31st, 2017 is the projected date on which Yucca Mountain will begin accepting nuclear waste, barring any litigation or licensing delays. And there won't be any of those, because there haven't been so far. Nevada officials, including Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, have vowed to block the multi-billion-dollar project's completion. The complexity of the computer program, another story has indicated, is needed to do safety projections every year for the next 10,000, you see. You need to do a safety projection for every year for the next 10,000 in order to know whether you're okay with this Yucca Mountain thing. Clean, safe nuclear fuel, ladies and gentlemen, is going to save us all. And now, I'm going to read the trades for you. Bet they never had the trades read on the radio in Georgia before this. It's the new age, babe. And by babe, I mean ladies and gentlemen of Georgia. It's just shorthand for that. From hotelinteractive.com, the trade website for the hotel business, new Department of Commerce figures show continued decline in overseas travel to U.S. I'll read it for you. Figures just released from the U.S. Department of Commerce show that far from enjoying a full recovery, America's travel economy continues to lose millions of overseas visitors, costing America billions in revenue and preventing the U.S. from utilizing its greatest public diplomacy tool. No, not Karen Hughes. Us. Quote, we have lost nearly 60 million international travelers since 9/11, and the problem is only getting worse, unquote. Jeff Freeman, executive director of the Discover America Partnership, coalition of American business leaders working to strengthen America through the power of travel. He continues, as travel around the world skyrockets, the U.S. is mired in a slump. It's time for Congress to address this growing problem in a way that both strengthens our security and improves the efficiency of the travel process. Yeah. Betting on that. Figures reveal that overseas travel to the U.S. remains below pre-9/11 levels in six of the top eight overseas markets. A survey last year of overseas travelers conducted by the Discover America Partnership found, apparently they were discovering America, negative perceptions of the U.S. entry process, the greatest deterrent in visiting the country. Overall, the number of international visitors to America finally returned to pre-9/11 levels last year, but most of the, actually all of the increase was accounted for by travelers from Canada and Mexico. I said international, and then they said Canada. Overseas travel has declined by 17% since 2001. I guess they're talking about legal visitors from Mexico. But the U.S. is taking action. On March 13th, the U.S. Senate passed positive reforms, according to this website, to America's travel process as part of legislation implementing concepts included in the 9/11 Commission report. Countless studies show that those who have visited America have more favorable opinions of the country and are more likely to support U.S. policies. I wonder what the figures would be on Americans traveling to Europe. What they think of Europe and Europe's policies. I'll just sit here and wonder that for a moment. An increase of 10 million more visitors could create 190,000 new American jobs, $16.5 billion in new spending, and nearly $3 billion in new tax revenue. Among the steps suggested by the website to regain the overseas travelers, creating a global promotion program to better explain U.S. policies. Karen Hughes, aren't you doing that? Karen? Hello? And introducing customer service techniques at the nation's airports. Well, that's just a built-in segue to this as I conclude reading the trades for you. This is a tale of airport security from Professor Walter Murphy, Emeritus, Professor of Princeton University, a scholar of public law and political science. The background on him is he's hardly a conventional political or legal liberal. He holds some opinions on welfare similar to opinions held on the left. He's also a sharp critic of Roe versus Wade and supported the nomination of Joe Alito. Quote, on March 1st of this year, I was scheduled to fly on American Airlines to Newark, New Jersey to attend an academic conference. When I tried to use the curbside check-in at the Sunport, where is that, in Phoenix? Somewhere. I was denied a boarding pass because I was on the terrorist watch list. I was instructed to go inside and talk to a clerk. At this point, I should note I'm not only a professor of jurisprudence, but also a retired Marine colonel. I fought in the Korean War as a young lieutenant, was wounded and decorated for heroism. I remained a professional soldier for more than 5 years and then accepted a commission as a reserve officer for an additional 19 years. I presented my credentials from the Marine Corps to a very polite clerk for American Airlines. One of the two people to whom I talked asked a question and offered a frightening comment. Have you been in any peace marches? We ban a lot of people from flying because of that, unquote. I explained that I had not so marched, but had, in September of last year, given a lecture at Princeton, televised and put on the web, highly critical of President Bush for his many violations of the Constitution. Said the clerk, quote, that'll do it. After carefully examining my credentials, the clerk asked if he could take them to TSA officials. I agreed. He returned about 10 minutes later and said I could have a boarding pass, but added, I must warn you, they're going to ransack your luggage. On my return flight, I had no problem with obtaining a boarding pass, but my luggage was lost. Airlines do lose a lot of luggage, and this loss could have been a mere coincidence in light of previous events. However, I'm a tad skeptical. Remember him? He used to be a daytime TV show host, tad skeptical. All right, thank you, Professor. And one more tale. Dear Harry, several months ago, after spending a week in Iowa, well, that's customer service at the airport. The guy told him. That'll do it. Dear Harry, several months ago, after spending a week in Iowa with only the clothes on my back because the airline had lost my luggage, I got to the Moline Airport to find that my luggage had been sitting there all but one day that I'd been in Iowa, and the airline had neglected to let me know. Their automated phone service had also not registered my luggage as being there. I decided not to risk it on the way back and stuffed everything I had planned to check into my carry-on bag. The TSA officer at security promptly unpacked most of the contents of my bag, so he could remove the toothpaste I had brought with me. I thought he hadn't seen the razor that I also had packed, and I asked if he needed to confiscate it as well. He asked if it was a safety razor, and I said yes. He said as long as it was a safety razor, I could carry it on. Confused? No. It's just another tale of airport security. Copyrighted feature of the broadcast.
Here we go then.
We'll be right back.
This is the show, and these are the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
You know, really, we should be doing the whole show just... And we... Who else knows? I should do the whole show on apologies this week, because this is the week for apologies, ladies and gentlemen. And they'll take up a good portion of the show starting right now. From Sunday's Washington Post, an op-ed by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Hey, Fredo! Quote, my decision some months ago to privately seek the resignations of a small number of U.S. attorneys has erupted into a public firestorm. I appreciate the public service of these fine lawyers and dedicated professionals. I apologize to them, their families, and the thousands of dedicated professionals at the Justice Department for my role in allowing this matter to spin into an undignified Washington spectacle. Unquote. Alberto Gonzalez. Wait till you see how it spins on Tuesday, babe. Dateline New Orleans. Ed Blakely, the hurricane recovery czar for the city of New Orleans, has been backtracking from several recent comments, beginning with an interview and speech in Australia last week in which he said city population numbers used before Katrina hit were too high. Now he's pilloried this week for saying that anyone moving into New Orleans from elsewhere was going to say, quote, who are these buffoons? He apologized Friday and said stress and illness clouded his judgment. I apologize. I think the people deserve better, and I'm going to do better, said Blakely. In an interview with the New York Times, he said if people from elsewhere in the country move to New Orleans, they're going to come here without the same attitudes as the locals. I think if we create the right signals, they're going to come here and they're going to say, who are these buffoons? His written statement of apology to colleagues was issued on Thursday. He said buffoons was a very inappropriate word, and said he was referring to a few people outside city government who seemed to be bent on stopping the progress we're trying to make. He did not elaborate on who those people might be. But he did say, I don't think we have buffoons here. Unquote. I thought we did. That was one of the reasons I liked it here. Blakely said he recently underwent a medical procedure, quote, and I didn't know whether I was going to be around for very long, unquote. He didn't say what kind of procedure he had or what his illness was, just it was a procedure too many males have to face. Ouch. My prognosis was not good, but that's been turned around, he said. Talking about turnarounds, you know, the old thing they used to say when you were a kid, if your feet smell and your nose runs, you're upside down. Mayor Ray Nagin told reporters that he and Blakely had a very frank discussion and that he, Nagin, told Blakely to stay focused on recovery work and leave commentary for other people who do that for a living. In other words, Ray Nagin is telling someone else to stop making wacky comments. We are upside down. Deadline Washington. Leaks to the media forced Defense Secretary Robert Gates to speed up releasing his decision to increase tour lengths for soldiers assigned to Iraq and Afghanistan from a year to 15 months. The notification of the decision to soldiers and their families was made simultaneous with the news briefing, and Army Lieutenant General Ray Odierno apologize to the families, many of whom heard about the decision on television. Deadline Baghdad. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry Friday said Iraqi Foreign Minister Hoshyar Zebari has officially apologized to Egypt for breaking into the Egyptian consulate in Baghdad. The report quoted Egyptian Foreign Ministry spokesman Ala El Hadidi as saying that Zebari blamed the incident on irresponsible people and that the Iraqi authorities conducted an immediate probe into the incident. Deadline Detroit, Ford Motor Company chief executive. Oh, Tom, do you want to help me with this?
Yeah, Alan Mulally.
That's right, Alan Mulally is no longer laughing about his suggestion that he saved President Bush's life during a recent White House visit. Ford apologized after Mulally said his claim of intervening to prevent U.S. President Bush from plugging an electrical cord into the hydrogen tank of an experimental Ford vehicle had been meant as a joke. Ford said Mulally never expected the story he told journalists in New York last week would be taken seriously. He found himself in an embarrassing situation when the story was featured on blogs and mainstream media like the Financial Times, which said he may have saved the incumbent of the Oval Office from blowing himself up. Ford said Mulally's anecdote had been inspired by a video spoof on the Jimmy Kimmel live talk show that suggested Bush blew himself up by plugging the cord in the wrong outlet. I tried to tell a joke about it and proved I am no Jimmy Kimmel, Mullally said. A British teen whose parents were left with a, well, let's see, this would be about a $40,000 bill after a party advertised on the MySpace website got out of control, apologized to her parents. Rachel Bell, 17, claimed her webpage was hacked into by friends who posted an invitation to a trash the average size family house disco party, prompting teenagers laden with alcohol to descend from around the country. Her mother, Elaine, whose wedding dress was urinated on by revelers, discovered the damage after returning from a holiday with her husband, Alan, and described it as a house rape. Rachel is in hiding and too ashamed to face her parents, but she penned an apology in today's edition of her local newspaper, the Sunderland Echo. In a story that should never have been more than local news, the local prosecutor in Durham, North Carolina, who charged three Duke lacrosse players with raping a stripper, has apologized to the athletes and said the North Carolina Attorney General's decision to drop the case was right. To the extent that I made judgments that ultimately proved to be incorrect, I apologize to the three students that were wrongly accused, says Mike Nifong. The Dateline New York, the United Nations has apologized for postponing the opening of an exhibit marking the anniversary of the Rwanda genocide over Turkish objections to a reference to the killing of Armenians in Turkey during World War I, says the Rwandan ambassador. Nobody's apologized for the genocide, but they're apologizing for a delay in the exhibit marking the anniversary of the genocide. Roseanne Barr, after her controversial remarks on the radio this past weekend, what? Did you know about this? Where she said gays don't care about anyone but themselves, Roseanne this week posted the following apology on her website. Quote, I deeply regret that I've offended gay people. I said things that I do not really mean before I'd thought them through. I was wrong and I seriously apologize, exclamation point. What I really meant to say, which was that everybody needs to unite right now and step outside of their own neighborhoods, groups, races, and classes to stop Bush's war on our country and our people. I love gays and I hate division. I am just a big idiot with a big mouth sometimes. I will learn to be more careful. Please forgive me. I am so sorry. 4 exclamation points. And finally, it's a very interesting sound, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? Oh, finally.
I made a mistake for which I am sorry. But let me also ask for some understanding. Not only was this a painful personal dilemma, but I had to deal with it when I was new to this institution and I was trying to navigate in uncharted waters. The situation was unprecedented and exceptional.
Paul Wolfowitz apologizing for having made sure that his girlfriend, Shahariza, when she was posted to a new job at the State Department because she couldn't work at the World Bank because her boyfriend was running the World Bank, Paul Wolfowitz. He set the conditions for her new job at the State Department, i.e. her salary and her promotions, so that she, Shahariza, working at the State Department, under Liz Cheney for a while, no. In the chart, is making more money than Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State. He's beset by controversy. The World Bank Staff Association, representing 10,000 employees, asked him to step down amid those charges. The board of the World Bank is investigating the matter. And there's also controversy because he appears to have tried to change the policy of the World Bank regarding promoting contraception. The Government Accountability Project has accused the bank's managing director, under Wolfowitz, of attempting to radically alter a longstanding health strategy at the World Bank. This according to the Financial Times. The managing director instructed subordinates to strike out references to combat AIDS from a funding package requested by Madagascar. There was no explanation provided. The staff said there's a widespread perception within the bank that the emphasis on contraception and preventing disease was being altered following his appointment, the managing director's appointment, by Wolfowitz. More on that story, one would hope, in the week to come. And, of course, Don Imus apologized his way right out of a job this week. And the apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The Imus story ricocheted around the media and is still doing so. He appeared on Reverend Al Sharpton's radio show last Monday, hoping to quell the uproar and instead stimulated it. And, of course, the press conference by the members of the Rutgers women's basketball team on Tuesday, live on national television, sort of sealed the deal. The report I saw was that Imus was going to be interviewed by Larry King, who's, as you know, celebrating his 50th anniversary of doing something this week. And that appearance, we were told, was canceled. Or was it?
Now, celebrating his 50th year in live broadcasting of Larry King, here's Larry King Live.
We're on tape tonight, so we won't be taking your calls, but of course your emails are always welcome, wherever you want to send them. We're in New York tonight, flying back out to Los Angeles tomorrow, where the great Nathan Al's Delicatessen is dedicating a sandwich to me, to Larry King, which is ham with tongue on corn rye. I got to have a couple of those. Tonight, in our New York studio, I don't know if I'm allowed to call him the great Don Imus anymore, but he's still Don Imus, who was fired this week by both CBS and NBC. I don't know if anybody else in show business can say that.
What's that, Larry? Fired by both CBS and NBC in the same week?
Yeah. that's a show business first.
Unless Charlie Rocket was moonlighting on Falcon Crest when he said the F word on Saturday Night Live.
Don, seriously.
You know, I'm lucky I didn't have a gig at ABC. They could have gotten in on the whole firing thing, too. Yeah. You know, they got just as big a bunch of hypocritical jerkasses as these other two outfits. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that.
Don, are you bitter?
Well, now, just exactly what kind of Alzheimer-headed Jew can you be to ask me that question, Larry? Of course I'm bitter, and I'm mainly bitter about myself for making that stupid joke.
The one about me?
The one about the Rutgers basketball team.
Yeah.
And the one about you.
Well, the one, the Rutgers is the one, the joke we've all read about.
The one that got me canned, Larry. I'm sure word got out to the motion picture home, didn't it? I'm sorry about that.
Is there anything about this week, aside from telling the joke itself?
I mean, it wasn't even a joke. It was just...
Let me just get this question out while I got it. Right. Is there anything else about this week that you regret, Don? Do you regret going on Al Sharpton's radio show?
See, now, isn't that the craziest state of affairs? Al Sharpton has a radio show and I don't. I mean, what kind of stupid country is this?
You know, Don, I've been in this business for 50 years this week. Tomorrow night, Barbara Walters inducts me into the Talk Show Hall of Fame, and I've never seen the kind of uproar you stirred up with this. What do you think happened?
Well, I think you and Barbara Walters made some kind of kiss-ass.
No, I mean, what happened with you?
Look, Larry, rather than even try to answer that question, let me answer the one I would have asked, which is, what happened when I met with the Rutgers women's basketball team?
I was getting to that. We got an hour to fill here.
Yeah, I know. First, I got to say, not a single one of them was nappy-headed, not a one.
Huh.
So that's just totally my bad there. That's just, you know, we had these tiny little monitors in that studio the cheap bastards at MSNBC wouldn't spring for, you know, like the big flat piece of crap behind Wolf Blitzer, for God's sake. And I have, you know, nothing but respect for Mr. Blitzer.
No, yeah.
And I'm sorry if he took that remark the wrong way. And second, I explained to the girls and to their coach that I call my wife a hoe, I call my mother a hoe. You know, at the ranch, 10% of the kids with cancer that we take care of are African Americans, and the ones that are girls, I call them hoes. None of them have, you know, threatened to leave the ranch because of it, because, you know, it's to me, it's always been like a kind of like a term of respect.
And what did the basketball team say?
They kind of giggled, which, you know, I haven't been getting many laughs this week, so...
Yeah, it's like Jackie Vernon on a slow night coming back to the hotel and tumbling with the information operator on the phone.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like, Larry. Good reference. Makes me sound young.
Don, getting back to the Sharpton radio show appearance, a lot of people have asked why you didn't do a Michael Richards and go on Jesse Jackson's radio show instead.
Well, for God's sakes, on a Sunday, crappy time slot, that was Easter, you know, and also, now Jesse's really Chicago. Sharpton is New York's very own con man, so I just thought, you know, that was the way we would go. I mean, if I could have gotten on Oprah, I would have, but that bitch has an attitude these days that's bigger than her hairdo. I guess I'm sorry for saying that, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do want to say, Larry, in all sincerity, that after I met with the Rutgers women's team, who are all lovely young women, very articulate, I went and my producer, Bernie McGurk, went and found some actual black hookers with unstraightened hair, and I went up to Harlem and apologized to them, too.
Yeah.
So I don't know what more I could have done, you know, maybe washed Reverend Al's car or something.
Don, what are you going to do now? Satellite radio? Will your old rival Howard Stern open the door to you at, what is it, Sirius?
Yes, it's Sirius, you pathetic old Jew fart. Sorry, Lance. Sorry, I was just trying to be unfunny there. Look, I doubt if Howard's going to share his satellite with us, that might make his dipstick go soft for posterity. But, you know, our radiothon made twice as much money this year with all the uproar, so I don't know. Maybe we start up an NHH foundation, try to keep this thing going.
NHH, that would be nap.
Don't say, man, you need the gig. You got that hot young wife to support. What do you strap on to keep her happy? I'm sorry, Larry, both to you and to what's-her-name, Sheena?
Sean. Oh. But, I mean, there's podcasting, the great Al Franken's running for senator, maybe there's politics in your future.
Yeah, that's smart, Larry. Getting fired by two networks is vote bait.
Yeah, well.
I can't see it, but, you know, I'm going to have something in common with people in politics because I'm definitely going to have to be spending a little bit more time with my family next little while. and I should add, with those very sick children, 10% of which are African-American, and I guess I'm sorry about pointing that out so often, too.
Finally,
Larry, those suspenders of yours, they're holding up your pants or your pecker. Jesus, I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry.
That's the kind of humor we're going to miss, Don. Speaking of missing, do you miss having sidekicks around to actually laugh at what you're saying?
Well, I do, but fortunately, they're still climbing over to the house in the morning just to riff and read some of the old commercials with me. So,
and in our waning moments in this segment, we got Reverend Al Sharpton calling in. Reverend Sharpton, how are you?
I'm fine, Larry. I just wanted to give Mr. Amos a little encouragement in this his hour of need.
Encouragement? This is a new one.
Well, I heard him say that he thought being fired by two networks might stand in the way of him having a political career. And I just wanted to say my having been so publicly wrong for so publicly long on the whole Tawana Brawley affair didn't stop me from running for president. I think Mr. Amos would be at least as entertaining in the debates as I was. So, Mr.
Brother Al, I appreciate the sentiment. It's later in coming than Larry on his birthday, and I'm sorry about that, but I'd take it in the spirit in which it's meant.
And that might be a mistake. Don Imus and Al Sharpton wrapping up this segment. Coming up, Larry Burkhead's attorney taking your calls.
We shall gather at the river with each other, 'cause you're my brother, and dip our souls, put in the water for the healing of each other. Saved and sanctified, freed from sin to where freedom lies, and fly away over land because we can. as we can.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now have new information about what's killing off the bees. Albert Einstein once said, according to a story in today's Independent, that if the bees disappeared, man would have only 4 years of life left. Theories of the die-off of bees. West Coast of the United States has lost 60% of its commercial bee population already. Theories involve mites, pesticides, global warming, and genetically modified crops. Now, a limited study has found bees refuse to return to their hives when mobile phones are placed nearby. Apparently, out of fear that the calls are for them. I know the feeling. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show.
It's not Harry's fault.
No, it's not. But the program does return next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, and over there in the Caucasus, around the world via the Internet at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, up and down the east coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ. 7.415 megahertz, available as a free download at www.audible.com/LaShow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like the conversation about race continuing. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks and to Bob Dunn and Jenny Lawson here at WWNO New Orleans. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. I'm going to go out and smell Bourbon Street.